Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. And today we're going to talk about Hollywood legend Joan Crawford, who, you know, Mike, I know you know all about Joan Crawford, was one of the first real movie stars to come out of film when film was in its infancy, and had so much to say about her career at MGM and then going to Warner Brothers. So in terms of, you know, a classic actress from the golden age of Hollywood, who started off like at the very, very bottom, she's a perfect person to talk about today. But, you know, born Lucille LeSueur in San Antonio, Texas, and apparently her parents were, her mother or father was a laundry laborer. This would come up later. And then she wanted to be a dancer and, you know, was a chorus girl and, you know, did some stuff with that and then, you know, broke into films. Now, I think it might be worthwhile to talk about the studio system and MGM being, you know, having more stars than the Galaxy or whatever their slug line was and how she fit into that. What do you want to say in terms of early Joan Crawford, her upbringing, her background, and her early roles?
As I start to talk about her early roles, the beginning of her career, let me preface that by giving a sense of what Joan Crawford meant at the height of the studio era, which is essentially what we're talking about at the moment, classic Hollywood. Sometimes people make a distinction between being a movie star and being an actor. In other words, you know, there are great movie stars, not all great actors. And that we could spend hours just going over that point, right? But with Joan Crawford, she's definitely one of the biggest movie stars of that era. The extent to which she was an actor, I would say yes, but, you know, essentially it's persona identified acting. It's Joan Crawford being Joan Crawford in role after role. But it becomes more complicated than that because there are several distinct phases in her career. And before I get to that first phase, which is what you're asking about, those early years, I want to give a sense of just what the Joan Crawford persona was like. And if people are not familiar with her as one of the really enduring legends of Hollywood. And I want to give three brief quotations that I think really speak to that. The first comes from the director, George Cukor. He was particularly well known for working with actresses, what was called a woman's director. And we're going to talk about women's pictures, weepies, if you will, two handkerchief pictures, that kind of Hollywood melodrama. But whether making a film like that or a lighter comedy, Cukor was known for working with women. Indeed, one of Joan Crawford's signature roles is in George Cukor's The Women in 1939. And so here's what Cukor had to say about the image of Joan Crawford. She believed in the Hollywood legend, and she was a creature of it. She represented the best in the golden period of Hollywood. She started as a personality girl, a dancing flapper, and made herself into an excellent actress. She had a wonderful bone structure that made it impossible to photograph her from a bad angle. So he's able to talk about her in very technical terms. I mean, when she's framed in the shot, she holds that shot, doesn't she? She has a great, strong face, and she's often suffering and crying and emoting and all that. But that's a powerful visual image there. Now, the other two quotations I have, and they're both very short, are from Joan Crawford herself. She said once this, "I carry myself regally. I'm only 5'4½", but I look much taller. I always wear 3½-inch heels, and I never even slump mentally. I walk tall." Indeed, she does. When you see her in the movies, it's not just the boxy shoulder pads, which I know Marie will want to talk about in a bit, you know, that fashion look, if you will, but she was a broad, if you will. In other words, she had a sense of presence, of physical presence, which far exceeded her actual dimensions. I'm trying to think how to discreetly put this. I mean, she was not physically a large person, but she was a large movie star. So a lot of it is facial bone structure, standing tall in those high heels, all the ways in the force of personality, all the ways in which a person who's frankly on the short side, and many of the great actors were actually, you know, does somehow loom larger in the frame and in the public conscience. So the final of the three quotes is very brief. It also comes from Joan Crawford in terms of that, you know, the image she projected and held to tenaciously. Here's what she said. "If I'd ever been seen on the Sunset Strip with bare feet and my hair uncoiffed, I would have killed myself." And so now, Marie, doubling back on your initial question, it's important to remember that she was born Lucille LeSueur. It's S-E-U-E-U-R. And so, you know, this is a name that is not going to play very well on movie screens. So she begins really, again, her working class origins, Lucille LeSueur. She becomes a dancer. She appears in many different cities, and chorus lines under various stage names. It's really, in some ways, the kind of hard scrabble working class background that other actors of her generation, like Barbara Stanwyck, one of the people we've talked about in an episode here, very similar in that respect, tough women who had to make it, not just in a man's world, but just in the world, right? So here she is, you know, she's making it. She's discovered in a New York chorus line by an MGM agent. She's signed to a contract. One of the first things they do is they say, Lucille LeSueur. I mean, you know, if you see it spelled out and you give it a nice French pronunciation, it looks okay. If she were a movie star in France or something. But if you're in America and you're saying, oh yeah, who's the star? Lucille LeSueur. It sounds like a sewer, doesn't it? And MGM thought, image. We can't have a famous actor or any actor named for sewage, right? So they did a very Hollywood thing. They had a nationwide publicity contest to come up with a new name for her. She made her first movie in 1925. Her initial roles, actually, bit roles, were as Lucille LeSueur. And that you see that in the title card. It's like, no. We got too many jokes will come on this. So anyway, nationwide publicity contest. The public comes up with, somebody put forward the name Joan Crawford. When you think about it, you can't mispronounce it. It's easy to spell. It fits on a movie theater marquee. You know what I mean? It's memorable that way. It's a nice, punchy, direct name. And that became her name. Now, she was quite prolific in that early period, Marie, that you're asking about. But the one film I would single out from the mid to late 1920s is a film called Our Dancing Daughters from 1928. She is the quintessential flapper. And this is the first phase of Joan Crawford's career. She's really light on her feet. She's a dancer, after all. She's actually relatively lightweight, if you will. She doesn't have that formidable presence yet. She's kind of giddy and happy and what you expect from a flapper. She doesn't have those shoulder pad outfits yet. After all, it's the 20s, right? It's you know, 10, 15 years prior to that look. She's very much a flapper. And indeed, people like F. Scott Fitzgerald, the novelist, who certainly would know about flappers, they noticed her. They liked her image. She was becoming a movie star and would be a major movie star for MGM in the years immediately following. So let me turn it back to you at this point.
I'm glad you mentioned F. Scott Fitzgerald because he considered Joan Crawford in this film as the ultimate depiction of a flapper, Our Dancing Daughters. And I watched this for the first time the other day and was struck by how this is the movie that made Joan Crawford a star. First of all, she looks really young. And secondly, you know, I came to Joan Crawford in her later career. So I, you know, think of her as this harridan, this, you know, the tough woman. Crawford's actually a great name for her because, you know, just so many things stick in her craw, almost like a claw. You know, there's a viciousness to the name. It's sharp, it's direct, which is what she became. But, you know, you look at these early roles that she did and she's just the girl next door. She's, you know, somebody you can imagine being friends with, somebody that female audiences would like. And then there comes this whole period of time where she does what I think about. You think about the era, you know, it's prohibition and suffragettes and women coming into their own. But they are still casting them in movies like, I just have a sampling of some of the titles of movies that she was in. The Casting Couch, Lady of the Night, Tramp, 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 Dance, Fools, Dance, Laughing Sinners, and The Gorgeous Hussy. Now, in the early 30s, she was tired of playing these fun-loving flappers, and she wanted to change her image. And she actually had really thin lips, so she, you know, did something with the smear of color across her upper and lower lips, which became iconic for her. But what's interesting for people today is that Joan Crawford's often credited as helping to change America's prejudice against lipstick. Because, you know, painted ladies and women who wear makeup, this was not at all commonplace or accepted. And I think she kind of led the way. Then she would go on to make a couple of movies in 1932. I want to mention Rain and Grand Hotel. But before we jump into that, Mike, is there anything you wanted to say about pre-1930s Joan Crawford?
Yeah, I don't want to force this point, but when I mentioned Barbara Stanwyck earlier, since you and I both love her as an actor and we talked a lot about her early career, you look at those pre-code films, as they're called, from the very early 30s, and the titles are hilarious because, you know, the films were certainly risque by the standards of that day. And the titles today still make me giggle. I mean, I've seen enough of them and others, even if I haven't seen them, the title sort of tells you everything, doesn't it? You know, Gorgeous Hussy. Yeah, I'd go to see that, right? You know, I mean, these are very saleable titles. And so Crawford did have that sort of giddy, happy-go-lucky. It's actually a very different image from what we think of. Marie, I like what you say, because most people would have discovered her later in her career, right? That, you know, this formidable, strong, tough, a kind of scary image, right? And even in terms of, you know, the full eyebrows, the full lips, the full face, if you will, formidable. But that early image is very, very different. And one of the things, I'm so glad you mentioned this as well, she was really young. And she, you know, think just a few years earlier, she had won a Charleston contest. And that gets her, you know, into better Broadway shows and, you know, dance gigs, if you will. And that leads to the MGM agent seeing her and giving her a contract. It's storybook material, right? And initially, she's just like one of the girls in the chorus line who's got a really bright personality and just happy-go-lucky. And yes, when we mentioned Scott Fitzgerald, he would notice somebody like that in the chorus line and in her early movies. That's the image. Get into the early 30s, and she's now part of the studio system in terms of making or manufacturing a star. She's becoming a star, and you're absolutely right, Maria. I'll hand it back to you in a second here. But, you know, when you think of Rain, one of the versions of Sadie Thompson, the Somerset Maugham tale, you know, how she's really good as a Sadie Thompson type character. And in Grand Hotel, where she plays a stenographer. And, you know, that's one of those all-star casts. And you know what? This is one of the things that makes her a star in Grand Hotel. It's a big budget, splashy, you know, one of the top films of the year kind of thing. And she's on screen with some of the top actors in Hollywood, certainly at MGM, and she holds her own. You know what I mean? She's in some heavyweight company, you know, and you've got John Barrymore type actors, and she can hold her own there. And you see that she's becoming more assertive as an actor. She's starting to become what we think of as Joan Crawford. Not quite yet in terms of full-blown Joan Crawford, but she's on her way. And one thing about Joan Crawford is nothing was going to stop her. This is sort of an unflattering comparison, but she's like a freight train that's just heading down those tracks and nothing's going to slow it or stop it. It's on its way. She had that drive, that ambition. That's going to lead to some of her greatest roles. And of course, you know, some more problematic aspects of that in her private life, if you will, but a very strong personality. So Marie, let me hand it back to you because I think you're absolutely right. That 1932 probably is the pivotal year in going from phase one of Lucille Lesueur's career, Joan Crawford's career, to phase two, the Joan Crawford we think of when we think of Joan Crawford.
And I think with Rain, you know, she plays a prostitute who's arrived in the South Pacific and she's at odds with this missionary who's determined to save her soul. One little fun detail about that movie is that they bought this checkered dress that she wears off the rack. And the costumer didn't realize, you know, you need more than one of the dress because, you know, you're going to be shooting over multiple days, et cetera. So they went back to the store to get another one and they were all gone. So they actually had to laboriously paint some other fabric to look just like the checkered dress and then make it into, you know, subsequent dresses for Joan Crawford to wear. And, you know, they'd gone through all the trouble to get a store-bought dress to save money, only to completely bust the budget with having to continue with the continuity work. Now, this time, Joan Crawford was married to Douglas Fairbanks Jr., and she discovered that she was pregnant during filming. The marriage was on the rocks, so she had an abortion. And the reason I mention that is because, you know, you mentioned Barbara Stanwyck, and they were friends. And we have mentioned in other shows about Barbara Stanwyck and talking about Joan Russell. You know, a lot of these women at this time had abortions and then could never have children again. A lot of these famous stars, including Joan Crawford, that actually is going to come up later when she tries to start a family. But you're right, she is starting to become the Joan Crawford that we know because of her eyes. Her eyes just are so piercing. They're so large. They're so expressive that you can't look away from her. So again, in 1932, she does Grand Hotel, which is about a bunch of different individuals staying at a luxurious hotel in Berlin. And she plays the stenographer. And at first, she didn't want to do that role because she thought, most of her, what she did would be censored because it was a pretty provocative and racy role. And they said, oh, no, it's going to be filmed in a tasteful manner. But what would end up happening is that a lot of her scenes were taken out for indecency, which of course just makes you want to know more about what they cut, right? In 1933, she appears in a Coca-Cola advertisement. 22 years later, she would marry Pepsi-Cola board chairman Alfred Steele. Now, you know, we're talking about the MGM years, you know, very controlling, all the way down to telling her in the contract what time she had to go to bed at night. You know, they really owned you when they signed you, but they would develop your career. You know, you would start off doing chorus girl parts. And then, you know, you move on to the hooker with the heart of gold kind of parts. And then, you know, you finally get into what I think of as the shoulder pad era, where Joan Crawford just owns that screen. And like you said, nothing was going to stop her. She was very, very driven. So by the time she gets to 1939 and The Women, which was a complete women's story. I mean, women actors. I mean, I think even the animals that they used in the movie, they made sure were female animals, you know, just really meant to like dig in deeply to the lives and loves and scandals of a group of interrelated women. And she got to sink her teeth into that. How did you see the Women, Mike, in terms of where it fits in her career?
Well, you know, to reinforce some of the points you're making, as she's working at the perfect studio to be a movie star, MGM was the tops, you know, as they would be happy to remind you. I mean, they had big budgets, they had a glitzy image, all the glamour, if you will. And she was on that short list of, you know, the glamorous actresses there. And so it's a trade-off. You're right. On the one hand, the studio controls everything. But, you know, on the other hand, that has its advantages, right? You know, you have a great wardrobe. You know, if you get along well with the studio bosses, you get some of the plum roles. I mean, you know, it can really be the red carpet life, if you will. And in terms of how on-screen and off-screen tend to meld together, and psychologically, this is where you want to do some armchair psychoanalysis, as in what does it mean? After all, you know, when your birth name is Lucille LeSueur, and now you've become Joan Crawford, and people shout, Joan, Joan, is some part of you still looking around like, Joan, who's that? You know, at some point you become this movie star, and it's reflected in your private life. We'll talk about, you know, the fact that she was unable to have children and adopted, and of course, we'll get to Mommy Dearest presently. People will probably want to talk about it immediately, but we'll get there. But the fact that everything is Hollywood glamour. Her first husband is Douglas Fairbanks Jr. I saw him once at an event when he was very elderly, and I just was staring. I thought, my goodness, this is the son of Douglas Fairbanks. He was a movie star. He appeared with Greta Garbo and so on. I mean, and he was married to Joan Crawford. And I thought, that would be something to talk about. But the fact that she was marrying actors, she was married four times in all, Douglas Fairbanks and then French Otone, Philip Terry, arguably the only happy marriage there that would have lasted if the husband had lived longer was to Alfred Steele, who was the Pepsi executive. We'll get there when we get to the late career. But she had multiple marriages, as you expect a Hollywood movie star to have. And the fact that she generally, I mean, he was a CEO, her final husband, so he was, you know, a powerful businessman, but the previous ones were show business figures. The fact that it was a life of show business. Now, doubling back on the show business with The Women, you know, George Cukor, the ideal director for something like this. It really was, even as women's pictures went, it was a woman's picture in terms of just female characters and a storyline. And this is reinforcement of a basic demographic fact. A high percentage of the movie-going audience in the 1930s, and even more so, one could say, I think, in the early to mid-1940s, was female. Particularly in the World War II years, which are going to start just after The Women, you know, you have the men off at war fighting or working in factories or whatever, and the women on the home front, if you will. In other words, you know, statistically, there were a lot more women, if you will, going to the movies in those years for various reasons. And the maternal melodramas, as they were called, were very popular in the 30s and into the 40s, including for, you know, actors like Barbara Stanwyck again, right, you know, in some of those roles. The fact that, you know, we can make fun and call them, you know, weepies, women's pictures, two handkerchief pictures, whatever. Some of them are great films. I mean, any way you want to parse it and describe them as you will, there's some great films in there. In any event, even the ones that aren't so great were successful. They tapped into something. Here's one of the things they tapped into. During the Depression years, you know, women were working hard to keep everything together, to keep the household together. They were working oftentimes when they had to work, you know, and even if the husband had a job, it wasn't enough maybe to carry the house. And women were doing laundry and, you know, and doing jobs, anything to make some money. Anyway, and then, of course, in the World War II years, working in the factories, Rosie the Riveter or whatever. But anyway, hardworking women. I'm talking about at the moment on a legitimate path, a morally upright path of the working woman or woman who wants to work, hold the house. The melodrama that can adhere to that, right, in terms of when things aren't going so well. But then on a slightly more nefarious side, as you get into gangster films and then prototypical film noirs and another kind of melodrama, women who will do whatever it takes to get to the top. We on another show, again, Barbara Stanwyck, talk about Babyface, right? You're an ambitious young woman, how you literally will climb your way up the skyscraper, the corporate skyscraper to success, to getting what you want. You want the penthouse apartment, you want the mink coat, you want the jewelry, all that. What they'll do, you know, sleeping their way to the top or just clawing their way one way or another. Crawford would, you know, have her share of roles like that eventually too. Just, you know, you do what you need to do to make it. And maybe you're misguided, and maybe ethically there's some questionable things along the way, but you're in a tough environment and you're going to fight your way to survive. And that's the word, survive. Joan Crawford, in a lot of her roles, and certainly throughout her career, was a survivor. One reason she had several phases in her career was when one phase ended or morphed into something else at a certain point, it would have ended some careers, frankly. It didn't. She always found a way to kind of bounce back and keep going. And we'll talk about that in a little bit in terms of when she goes from MGM to Warner Brothers. But let me hand it back to you.
In 1942, they asked Joan Crawford to take over Carol Lombard's role in They All Kissed the Bride in 1942 because Lombard died in an airplane crash coming back from a war bond tour. Crawford then donated all of her salary to the Red Cross, which found Lombard's body, and promptly fired her agent for taking his usual 10%. Now, at this point, she's already got a feud going with Bette Davis, both of them trying to be, you know, the top box office draw. And yes, it's apparently legend that Joan Crawford slept around. Bette Davis said once that she slept with everybody at MGM except for Lassie. So she would go on finally in 1945 and get the recognition she craved with Mildred Pierce, which could have been the story of Joan's life. Mildred Pierce was an ambitious, lower class woman with a vain, evil, selfish daughter who competed with her mother for the same man. Mildred Pierce would later be hailed as one of the forerunners of Warner Brothers' film noir period. Now here's one of the slug lines for the movie. Mildred Pierce, loving her is like shaking hands with the devil. She gave more in her glance than most women give in a lifetime. Shh, please don't tell what Mildred Pierce did. She was nominated for the Oscar. She didn't think she was going to win. So her daughter says in her book that she completely faked being sick so that, you know, she wouldn't have to be embarrassed by not winning. But then she did win, of course, bounced out of bed and immediately started taking callers. And she has said about that, that whether the Academy voters were giving the Oscar to me, sentimentally, for Mildred, or for 200 years of effort, the hell with it, I deserved it. Now, she'd go on to make other movies, Sudden Fear in 1952 in particular, Johnny Guitar in 1954. But since we do have to be cognizant of the time, I say we jump right into whatever happened to Baby Jane in 1962, Mike, unless there's points you want to make about what I just skipped over.
Yeah, it's important to say a little bit more about Mildred Pierce. It was Joan Crawford's favorite role of everything she did. It's her greatest role. She wins the Academy Award as Best Actress for that. It's also the first film she makes for Warner Brothers. Her MGM films in the very early 40s are not working well at the box office for various reasons. The studio is actually phasing her out, and they are bringing in a new generation of stars. She sees that writing on the wall. She's very fortunate. When she goes to Warner Brothers, she makes some of her greatest films in the years ahead. And Mildred Pierce really is such a great film. The only thing I'll add to it, and then we can jump ahead. So we're not going to talk about some of her better films in the late 40s and through the 50s, but she makes some really good melodramas then. But I want to give a quote about Mildred Pierce to give a sense of how it dovetails with who she is as a person. The critic Andrew Saris wrote this in 1981, at the time when the screen version of Mommy Dearest was being released. He wrote this: how ironic it is that Joan Crawford's most famous part is that of Mildred Pierce, a mother tormented by an ungrateful child. Crawford projected much of her own social insecurity and paranoid self-justification into that deserved Oscar-winning performance. In a sense, Crawford reflected the monstrous obsession with power and status that was a legacy of the old Hollywood. So again, that really captures how this role is perfect for her. And the film itself is a fascinating fusion of that maternal melodrama we've been talking about and film noir. It works perfectly.
Now, when we get to Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, you know, they actually pit these two Hollywood legends, Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, against each other. And they assumed that they wouldn't get along, but apparently they, for most of the time, they got along well enough to make the movie. It's a movie where it's about two former stars. One is a child star, and the former child star torments her paraplegic sister in their decaying Hollywood mansion. There was a cartoon in the New Yorker of two women standing under a marquee of the theater. I like Bette Davis, said one woman, and I like Joan Crawford, but I don't think I'd like Bette Davis and Joan Crawford together. Well, it's a good joke, but honestly, together, they are just magnificent in that movie. It is so creepy and weird. It has things to say about old Hollywood. It has things to say about star power. it has things to say about not being able to move on from your career. It's a really great movie for both actresses. And I think she was always really angry about the fact that Bette Davis was nominated for an Oscar for this. And she was not, because of course she made a point of always looking like a glamorous movie star, assuming that that's what her public wanted, that they wanted her to be a movie star at all times, even if the character was supposed to just be a washed up ordinary woman living out her days in a mansion.
Bette Davis and Joan Crawford were two of the biggest stars on the Warner Brothers lot. They were extremely competitive. They had known and hated each other for a long time. The scenes in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane where they're fighting with each other, is that even acting? These two did not like each other at all. And it comes across viscerally in Baby Jane. It's a terrific film. It has so much camp value, if you will, that we should actually sometimes should do a show just about that particular film. One could talk for hours about it. So I share your admiration or just your sense of wonderment at Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. It's quite a film.
Now we're kind of coming to the end of our time here. I do want to mention briefly Mommy Dearest, which came out in 1981. This was actually where I discovered Joan Crawford and worked backwards from there. So you can just imagine what the character Joan Crawford had to overcome just from, you know, starting off as looking that way. And this, of course, was based on Christina Crawford's book about her mother and growing up, etc. One thing I will say about that book is that nobody talked about that topic to that extent until that book came out. So there's some question about the accuracy, of course, how much it's just mean-spirited vindictiveness, but if nothing else, it really did shine a light on that particular, you know, societal scourge. I also want to mention, because it's such a great anecdote, that the Small World attraction at Disneyland was donated by Joan. During the World's Fair, Joan was a member of the board of directors at Pepsi. She went to Walt Disney with the suggestion to create a ride dedicated to the children of the world. I think that song is one of the most irritating things of all time. So I don't know if she really wants to be known for that. But if you're interested in the feud between Betty and Joan, there's a great little miniseries out there called Feud, Betty and Joan from 2017. And Susan Sarandon plays Bette Davis and Jessica Lange plays Joan Crawford, and they chew up all the scenery and do a fabulous job of going into great detail of things you and I have only had a chance to glance off of. But that does bring us to the end of our episode. Don't forget to check out our other podcasts at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com, and we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.